We've just got one case scheduled on the 2:30 docket this afternoon in remarriage of Farmer. I see that counsel are set up and ready to proceed on that case. You should have all received a set of written instructions detailing our procedures in this court for oral argument. Let me ask if any of the counsel have any questions about those procedures.
I don't think so. Thank you, Judge Wald. No questions.
Great. I'd remind counsel when you come to the podium, if you would identify yourself by name and attorney registration number. And if anybody in the courtroom has a cell phone or a pager or anything like that, we'd ask that you turn it off now so as not to disrupt counsel in the court during argument. And with that, we are ready for argument and remarriage of Farmer.
Good afternoon. Mark Davis, attorney registration number 17778 on behalf of the appellant and the petitioner in the lower court, Catherine Irene Farmer. And I thank the judges for lending us the ear this afternoon. This is always a privilege to come before the panel. Thank you. As counsel for Ms. Farmer, I've analyzed this case, and I think that what this case comes down to is a battle between two ideas when it comes to determining the outcome of a marital maintenance obligation, whether that should be modified or terminated. And I believe that the battlefield in this particular case was one based upon whether or not the need of the appellant or the petitioner below, if the need is what should drive the determination in the lower court, or if it's something else. And I believe that that something else is what this panel and this court and its divisions, as well as the Supreme Court of the state of Colorado, have consistently come to the conclusion that no, we don't look at need when we're looking at termination or modification of marital maintenance under 1410.122. It appears that the case law seems to say that we are not going to look at that narrow issue. What we are going to look at is we're going to look at all the attendant circumstances of the parties, and then, of course, follow the statutory language and determine whether or not those attendant circumstances, when you take the complete picture into account, the court is then instructed to look at whether or not, of course, it's a substantial and continuing change of circumstances that makes the current order unfair. I'm reminded of a law school professor, a beloved law school professor who taught property, and he says he would count us down and he would fail us for the day if we used the word fair in our argument in response to his inquiries in class. And I think that what this panel has done, or this division of the court and the Supreme Court has done, is they fleshed out what it means whether or not a marital or spousal maintenance obligation should continue or not. And they have looked consistently and said, we're not going to place any participant or any recipient of marital or spousal maintenance at the position of having to rely only on their most basic needs. We are going to look at what happened during the marriage. And I think they do say, consider the circumstances of the marriage at the time of the original dissolution of marriage, the decree, and the orders thereafter. And they've come up with several different proposals in discussing fairness. And the one thing that they do not focus on, and I respectfully disagree with counsel in their briefs, it is not a narrow focus on the need of the person receiving the marital maintenance. The focus that they look at is whether or not the expectations of the parties at the time of the award are being met. And I think that this panel can look at the situation and ask, is this a situation in this particular case where Mrs. Farmer, my client, has been receiving spousal maintenance, and has she received it to a degree or to an extent that is something that would be unreasonably anticipated by any of the parties, either by Mrs. Farmer or by the husband, Mr. Farmer? Is her saving her property division payments, is her saving her maintenance payments over the years, is that something that would have been unreasonably foreseen by any of the parties in this particular case?
You're not arguing, are you, that need is irrelevant here, are you?
It certainly is not irrelevant, but Judge Lowe, but the analysis does not fall on minimal need. And that's where the case law seems to be falling in the state of Colorado. For instance, as I had cited extensively in my brief, in my responsive brief, the court is not going to look at a situation and say that, for instance, Mrs. Farmer has no right to make a savings for her retirement or to put away money for emergency situations or in order to put away money for things that she needs, such as a car. And some of the major problems I see in our lower court ruling in this case is the fact that they absolutely cut off any right to savings. They said the court's order in this particular case said, I am not going to consider savings on behalf of Mrs. Farmer. I'm going to deduct that from her needs. So when the court did that, I believe the court did abuse its discretion by doing so. And basically what the court said is, I'm going to ignore the fact that Mrs. Farmer has $960 per month in her program, in her need to save and to invest. And that's what she had done during the course of the marriage. That's what the parties had done, and that's what she continued to do. One other thing that the court did is Judge Tallman also cut out Mrs. Farmer's need to repurchase a motor vehicle. If you read the briefs, it says that her car was 10 years old, and she had allocated $466 per month for replacement of a vehicle, and the court in its order said, we're going to ignore that. There's no need for a vehicle. There's no need to save for an additional vehicle. There's no need to account for depreciation of that motor vehicle. So I do believe that the court did address need, but it did so improperly. And I believe that that's really the crux of the matter in this particular case.
I'd like to hone in on a fairly specific error that you're alleging, and it has to do with the consideration of the future retirement income.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, Judge.
On that, in the court's order, was that basically your complaint about what they enumerated as item 13?
I believe so. I believe so. The judge did say that in his order said that she wasn't entitled to any kind of retirement savings. One of my main arguments in this case, and I was going to get that to that toward the end of my presentation here, was Exhibit I, where the judge specifically said he was not going to consider that opinion, was not going to consider that evidence. And then we get the order, and twice in the order, the judge says, well, I'm going to consider future income based on evidence that I said I was not going to consider.
Yeah, and that's exactly kind of the area that I'm wanting to ask you about. In the order itself, it refers to the husband's testimony, and he did testify as his own expert, and there was testimony in addition to the actual document. So I was wondering why you think that the order refers to the document as opposed to testimony.
When you look at page 125 through 136 of volume one of the transcript, you'll see that there's a lengthy colloquy between the court and counsel and some give and take there. Mr. Farmer began to testify regarding that income, and then he was actually, if you look at the transcript, he was referring to the exhibit at the time that he was testifying. When counsel for Ms. Farmer objected, when I objected on her behalf, I objected to that particular expert testimony, and the judge said, yes, I'm not going to accept that evidence, and that's what the judge said. And I think this is one of those things where I think that the argument is, well, maybe I should have made a motion to strike that testimony. But I believe that as counsel arguing on behalf of my client, that when a judge says, I am not going to consider that evidence, I don't think that it puts the onus on me to have to itemize each and every thing that the judge is excluding. When the judge is telling me he's not going to consider the testimony or the evidence of the $11,000 future payment, I believe that I can rely upon that, and I don't think it's incumbent upon me to have to enumerate, you know, how many minutes back, how many questions back are we going. When the judge says he's not going to consider it, I believe I should be able to rely on that.
So your position would be that the objection to the document as untimely and the exclusion of the document basically acted to also exclude testimony, which technically wasn't objected to?
Well, I believe it is timely in the fact that Mr. Farmer was testifying off of that document. If you look at the transcript,
right.
He was testifying from the document. So if he's testifying from the document, and I then raise an objection once they have begun the process of offering that document into testimony, I believe that that constitutes a timely objection to that particular line of questioning. And I don't believe it requires a further indication. And I really think that that would be a hyper-technical objection in any case. I know that the objections and counsel need to be careful on those things, but I think in that particular case, it would be such a hyper-technical objection and a procedural aspect of this case. It would really work to do unfair justice to Ms. Farmer if it was just sort of a, you know, King's X, sorry you didn't say it soon enough, or you didn't say it broad enough. When the judge said, I'm not considering the evidence, I took that to mean he's not considering the evidence.
Can I go back to the deduction of the $460-some-odd for the car? My understanding, and maybe I've got this wrong, is that that was a car payment that she was making on the car and then ultimately didn't have to make anymore, presumably because it was paid off. Is that right or wrong?
No, the testimony was of Mrs. Farmer. Mrs. Farmer, how much would it cost you if you have to go replace your vehicle, how much will that cost you to do that? She testified, I have priced that and it will cost me approximately $466 to go out and purchase a new car. And she at that time had been driving a 10-year-old car. She was ripe to get a new vehicle. And basically the judge in his order said, you know, we're not going to allow you any car expense. And I think that's unjust in this case. If I could reserve my remaining time, please.
You've got about 4 minutes and 35 seconds left.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Timothy B. Walker, registration number 5351. Seated with me at the council table is my associate, Jamie Wright, registration number 35813. We represent the appellee, the respondent below, Ronnie Farmer. I must say that I respectfully disagree with my colleague that need is not really relevant when it comes to modifying spousal maintenance under CRS 1410.122. Clearly, need is a factor and is a relevant factor, as Judge Loeb, you did question. It may not be the only factor, but it is one. What must the court do when it comes to modification of spousal maintenance? It must determine whether there has been a change of circumstances so substantial and continuing as to make the prior award unfair. And in doing that, the trial court must consider the elements of CRS 1410.114. That is, does the spouse seeking maintenance have a reasonable need for maintenance? That is, are they able to support themselves through appropriate employment, or do they lack sufficient property, including marital property, to meet their reasonable needs? Now, we need to focus on that latter consideration. Does the spouse lack sufficient property to meet her reasonable needs?
Can I go back for just a second and ask a
yes.
question about standard of review here? As I understood how you characterize it, under the statute, first of all, there has to be a determination of whether there's been a showing of changed circumstances so substantial and continuing. I understand that.
Yes.
Okay, but then the court has to decide, okay, given that change of circumstances, is maintenance, continuation of maintenance still unfair?
That's correct.
With respect to the unfairness determination, what's our standard of review?
Your standard of review is whether the findings of the trial court constitute an abuse of discretion, or whether they are supported by the evidence, or whether there was error of law. I don't believe there was error of law in this case.
Well, my question is, here the judge said it's unfair.
Yes.
Okay, so my question is that something that we review de novo? Is that a factual finding, or is it an abuse of discretion standard?
Oh, Judge Loeb, I believe that's a factual finding. I think that the trial court is a trier of fact. The trial court was there. I was there, and Mr. opposing counsel was there, but this honorable court was not there, and you need to review the record as it stands, and I believe that the record contains ample findings that are supported by the evidence, factual findings, Your Honor, as to the finding that to continue the maintenance award in this case is unfair. Now, there's some case law I think that's very important for this court to consider. It's been cited in our brief. The Weibel case. Clearly, the Weibel case is, I believe, the appellate's strongest authority for the court, this court not considering, or a trial court not considering, savings by a recipient spouse as a factor. But I don't believe that the Weibel opinion says that in all cases the court should not consider savings by a spouse as a factor. It's clear that the evidence showed in this case that the wife was able to save a considerable amount of money, $5,000 a month, I believe, she was saving. And in the Weibel case, there are several distinctions between Weibel and this case. One, in the Weibel case, the wife's needs, reasonable needs, exceeded her income that was available to her, even including the spousal maintenance. In this case, there was no such excess. There was indeed a surplus. That is, the wife in this case was enjoying a surplus, including the maintenance that she was receiving. Number two, the wife's assets in the Weibel case had not materially changed since the original decree. Here, they almost doubled. They went from about $460,000 to $990,000 that the wife here was able to invest. Number three, the wife in the Weibel case suffered from chronic health problems, which clearly, according to the evidence, affected her ability to work and to earn income. Here, Judge Tomlin specifically found that the wife's testimony about her health concerns was not credible. In fact, the wife testified that she had no health conditions that affected her ability to work or to earn income. And significant in this case, the trial court had ordered in April of 2007 that Mr. Farmer, instead of paying spousal maintenance to his wife directly, was to pay it to the depository of the court. He did so faithfully for a period of 6 months. And during that time, the evidence showed that Mrs. Farmer was still able to increase her assets by $40,000 without even receiving any maintenance. All of those factors, I think, go to support the trial court's finding of unfairness of continuing the award. Another point of significance to this honorable court, I believe, is that in the Weibel opinion, it was a three-judge panel, but Judge Casebolt dissented. He did not agree with the majority that that the matter should be reversed. He thought that the evidence in Weibel clearly supported a termination, or in that case, a reduction of spousal maintenance. And I think that might be very significant. There's another case I think that the court should consider. I said there's a little law here I think that is important, and that's the Sim case, which is cited in our brief. Significantly, in the Sim case, the trial court talked about need, and it talked about a number of factors. In fact, the appellate court said, here, the trial court properly considered the wife's reasonable, in italics, needs, and was not bound to award maintenance so that the parties had an equal lifestyle forever, citing the In Re the Marriage of LeBlanc, which is also cited in our brief. Interestingly enough, further in the Sim opinion, the court went out of its way to note that maintenance need not continue indefinitely, citing the Fisher case. And clearly in the Fisher case, the court specifically said, we know of no case law authority in Colorado that says that maintenance should continue forever. And that's what we have here. Significantly, the husband in this case did pay, faithfully paid spousal maintenance for a period of 12 years, almost 12 years, from December of 1995 through October, I believe it was, of 2007, which was almost half the length of the 24-year marriage. It would be unfair, we assert, to require the husband, or for the trial court to have required the husband, to continue to pay maintenance to his wife, who was able to invest without the maintenance award, to contribute to her retirement, who had ample income. The wife's interest in dividend income, according to the evidence, was $5,000 a month. She had rental income, $850 a month. She had a house that was paid for. She had W-2 income from her employment. She was working, $2,500 a month, a total of $8,350 a month. What were her reasonable needs? Notwithstanding what she said in her revised sworn financial statement, the judge, Judge Tallman, deducted certain items from her reasonable needs. She invests $660 a month for investments, $300 a month for her retirement plan. He disallowed that. Her total needs, after Judge Tallman heard the evidence, he found to be $2,880 a month. Now, why then should my client, Mr. Farmer, be required to subsidize his former wife for more than 12 years with an award of spousal maintenance so that she can have about a $5,000 a month windfall? I submit that that is manifestly unfair, and I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
I don't think you have.
Oh, I don't. You're right, Your Honor. It's been so long since I've appeared. I'll keep on going. It's important, by the way, for this court to recognize a little bit more case law, because I was struck by Mr. Davis's assertion that need is not really very important. I think this is a need case. Specifically, the Aldinger case, which we cited in our brief, 813 Pacific 2nd, 836, 1991 Court of Appeals case. In that case, it was held clearly that the trial court should determine if there is a need for and an ability to pay maintenance. That's the standard. Is there a need for maintenance and an ability to pay? Now, we don't challenge, and we didn't challenge in the trial court, Mr. Farmer's ability to pay spousal maintenance. That was pretty clear.
What's the name of the case that you just said?
It's Aldinger v. Aldinger, A-L-D-I-N-G-E-R, 813 Pacific 2nd, 836, Court of Appeals, 1991.
You said you cited that in the brief?
I believe I did, Your Honor. Well, I stand corrected. I did not cite it in my brief. It is not cited in the brief. I do stand corrected.
Okay.
And if the court requires me to supplement the record on appeal, I can certainly do that.
Well, but stop the clock for just a second. Mr. Davis, since it wasn't cited in the brief, do you want to have a chance to either talk about that case here or to file a very short response giving your thoughts on that case?
Judge, well, I actually cited that case in my own plea, so I'm aware of the case, and we actually cited it.
Okay, then we won't worry about it then.
That's fine. I knew I had seen it, and it was in Mr. Davis's reply brief, I believe.
Sorry.
And that consideration under the Aldinger case should be made of need and ability to pay, should be based on the actual situation of the parties at the time. But what was the actual situation of the parties at the time? I believe I just outlined it. Mrs. Farmer was realizing about a $5,000 a month windfall over and above her reasonable needs as found by the trial court. In short, Your Honors, we believe that the findings of the trial court were amply supported by the evidence, and because they were amply supported by the evidence and by the record, we believe that there should be an affirmation of Judge Tomlin's award. I think if you examine his findings of fact and conclusions of law, you'll find that he cited the record, he cited the exhibits. I want to speak a little bit about Exhibit I, by the way, because I think there is a big distinction between a trial court excluding a documentary exhibit and making the stretch assumption that by excluding a document that strikes all of any testimony, expert testimony about the document. I don't believe that's the law in Colorado. Mr. Farmer was qualified as an expert, as a CPA in his field. My memory of whether he testified word for word from his document is a little bit different than Mr. Davis's memory. I think he testified freely without referring too much to the document. But again, that's why the trial court's findings are, if they're supported by the evidence and the record, are usually affirmed and no abuse of discretion is found, because your honors were not there. And in the time that it takes to appeal, memories fade, maybe even minds. And so, but I do want to emphasize that the trial court in this case, Judge Tallman, carefully considered the record. And my memory of that famous Exhibit I was that all Judge Tallman really excluded of that exhibit was the part that talked about the retirement income. And that's why I inquired of the expert in testimony so that he could supplement that with his own testimony from his own memory, which I believe he did. And in fact, in his findings, Judge Tallman specifically found Mr. Farmer's testimony to be credible. So
let me ask you a more substantive question, though. Whether or not there was a proper objection here, what's your view on whether it was appropriate for the trial judge to consider future retirement income in this analysis?
Well, that's interesting because I think that that's exactly what the trial court should and did consider in this case, and I think it was appropriate because we are a rehabilitative maintenance state. What does that mean? That means that the policy in this state is for a spouse receiving maintenance eventually to become self-supporting. The case law doesn't say not maintaining the lifestyle that was maintained during the marriage forever. That's clearly the Sim case. But what the parties need to do is to simply be rehabilitated. Well, I think that future retirement income, and again, Mrs. Farmer is to be commended for being frugal in that regard. She did provide for her retirement, and I think appropriately so. That's exactly what Mr. Farmer was doing. That's what any of us would have to do so that we can provide for our future, and that I think was a valid consideration by the trial court.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, you've got 4 minutes and 34 seconds for whatever rebuttal you would like.
Thank you very much. I would like to touch on Exhibit I once again for just a moment, and I think that when Judge Tallman said he was going to exclude the expert testimony as contained in Exhibit I, he did so because of a discovery violation, said that information was not provided on a timely basis. So I think it would be manifestly unjust to say, well, the trial court excluded the written document, but the trial court can go ahead and consider the oral testimony and basically get around the late discovery issue. I think that it's a serious problem when you would be saying disallow the exhibit and that provides the underlying data, but then go ahead and accept his oral testimony. That, frankly, was a sort of a foundational testimony leading up to his exhibit. So I think that that would be a manifest injustice if that were to happen. In regard to the recitation of our case law, oddly enough, we are citing many of the same cases. One of the things that was said in the briefs filed by my able opponent, it was that the driving question in this particular case is a question of need. And the Weibel case says exactly the opposite, that the driving question is not a question of need. The driving question is, what is the standard of living established during the marriage? And in this case, it was an extravagant standard of living. These folks, I believe the record shows that these folks had vacation properties in Vail. They had many vehicles. They had a lavish lifestyle. I don't want to recite the whole thing because I don't have a lot of time. And in this case, Mr. Farmer actually continued in that lifestyle. He had several resort properties. He had one or two residential properties. He had several business holdings. He continued in his lavish lifestyle while Mrs. Farmer basically shut down her lifestyle in concern for her retirement needs.
So your view of maintenance is not so much rehabilitative, but rather to continue the lifestyle that was had, some semblance of it during the marriage?
Well, certainly you'd look at that, and the case law says that you must look at that. You must look at what the lifestyle was during the marriage. And I don't believe that it is fair for Mrs. Farmer to have scrimped and saved all of those years to save for retirement, and then all of a sudden come to the court, and the court says, well, good job, well done. Looks like we're not going to allow you to maintain any kind of a lifestyle that you had during the marriage. You're going to own your home. You're going to own a 10-year-old car, and you're going to have a retirement account, but that's all you're going to have. We're not going to allow anything. We're not even going to allow you a new car. So I think when you look at the disparities, and again, the statute talks about unfairness, and as our case law says, and I believe it's Olar, the Olar case says that it's a heavy burden on the person trying to do away with the maintenance obligation. So I don't want to say that need is not a part of the analysis, and I don't want to be misunderstood on that point. What I am saying is that the court looked at Mrs. Farmer's need to an extent where she cannot possibly come close to enjoying the same standard of living that she enjoyed during the marriage, while Mr. Farmer did. A couple of other things I want to mention now that I only have a minute left. Counsel in their pleadings and their briefs say that Mrs. Farmer's holdings doubled. That actually is not the case. At the time of the dissolution, she had approximately $700,000 in assets. She ended up at this hearing having $960,000 of assets. She basically made $270,000 in savings and investment over a period of 12 years. And as you'll see in my brief, that's basically a rate of savings of about 3, depending on how you calculate it, 2.8 to 3.5%, basically passbook savings type rates. So this is not a person who invested extravagantly and took great risks and made a whole lot of money. If she just parked her money in a savings account, that's what she would have got. On the other hand, Mr. Farmer, when you look at him, again, I'm pleased that he was able to do so, but he ended up with $2.1 million in assets by the time this hearing rolled around, while Mrs. Farmer had $960,000. Is that unfair? I would suggest no.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This is our only case.